Before the sermon, please forgive me a moment of compelling curiosity that has afflicted me for about 4 weeks now. Sometime in my life, somewhere in my life, I apparently gave somebody a nickname, the nickname of Ross Perot Jr. And about 4 weeks ago, a call came to church from Texas. And whoever answered the call heard someone say, "Does Bob Myers still speak at this church?" "Yes, on occasion." "When is he speaking next?" "I think it's April the 7th. "Well, tell him that Ross Perot Jr. will be in the audience." Now, I have to confess to having forgotten to whom I gave that nickname. So Ross Perot Jr., wherever you are, if you are here, I want to be sure to see you when church is over. I had more interest in the Winter Olympics this year than ever before, partly because the alleged bribing of Olympic Committee officials threatened to end them before they got started, partly because they were so well run in Salt Lake City despite a judging scandal, and partly because I kept wondering how the Mormon Church was reacting, especially during one raucous, vulgar section of the closing ceremonies. Since some of you who felt the same way have been asking about that church's faith and practice, we'll take a look this morning at the Mormon world, otherwise known as the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. I confess up front my inability to believe the history of early America as presented in the Book of Mormon, but I find many things to admire in Mormon culture. I remind myself that most religions begin in miracle stories, which some later followers question, even while they are determined to stay loyal to their church, mosque, or synagogue. There are thoughtful Mormons, for example, who recognize that their founding father, Joseph Smith, made some insupportable claims. As one of those people, a historian and lawyer in Atlanta, says, "The starting point is that I am a committed Mormon. I know the Book of Mormon does not stand historical examination, but what really clicks, what really keeps us there, is the culture." Well, there are certainly thousands of people who continue to practice Judaism and Christianity even while they doubt the literal and historical accuracy of certain stories in the Bible. So while this Georgia attorney may be more openly honest than most, his decision is not all that unusual. I could never embrace all aspects of Mormon theology, but I understand his regard for Mormon lifestyle. After an occasional hungover student in a classroom or a couple of hours in a smoke-filled faculty meeting, I used to think sometimes how pleasant it might be to teach at the Mormons' Brigham Young University, where alcohol and tobacco are banned. Billy and I have stopped several times in Provo, Utah, during vacation trips, and marveled at the clean orderliness and the wholesome-looking students who mingled with us in cafes and on the sidewalks. Watching them, I thought of a scholarly friend who spent much of his life studying Mormon theology and culture because his wife had converted. He never did, but he makes two interesting comments about Mormons. First, that they have the most indefensible theology of any church he knows. And second, that they are as devoted to Christian principles as any people he has ever met. A paradox he has a hard time explaining. Let's confront the paradox, starting with a very brief glance at how the Mormon Church began. Many of you know the story of how a man named Joseph Smith said he was visited by an angel who led him to buried golden plates containing the Book of Mormon in a language which Smith called Reformed Egyptian. Linguistic scholars smile at that phrase and at his claim, and unfortunately, the plates are not available for examination, since Smith said that after a miracle helped him translate a language he didn't know, the angel took the plates back to heaven. When a church friend of mine asked, "Who could possibly believe such a story?" I reminded him that millions around the world would ask how he can believe that a man was born of a virgin, walked on water, raised the dead, and finally flew up through the sky after rising from the dead himself. Faith, after all, is seldom deterred by logic. So for Mormon believers, the book for which Joseph Smith claims divine origin is a true history of two tribes of Israel, the good Nephites and the bad Lamanites, who had battled each other for centuries before they migrated to North America and set up vast cities and an advanced culture long before Columbus arrived. Archaeologists find no evidence at all to support this amazing story, which goes on to say that Jesus himself showed up suddenly in that world and got the two tribes to reconcile for a while, until 400 years later, the Nephite leader named Mormon was killed along with hundreds of thousands of his people. It's a long, incredibly involved story, and perhaps one needs to be a true believer to read it with excitement or pleasure. Mark Twain thought so, who once satirized the Book of Mormon as chloroform in print. A judgment he would also have made, of course, about some parts of the Bible. Like the founders of all enduring religious faiths, Joseph Smith was charismatic and found followers, among them a young carpenter from upstate New York named Brigham Young. But the new faith very quickly encountered hostility because of what established religion called its heresies, and especially because of its tolerance of polygamy. Although plural marriages were advocated only in later revelations, books that came along after the Book of Mormon, and monogamy was the official doctrine of the church during Joseph Smith's life, he is said to have taken more than 30 wives, perhaps twice that many, to whom he had, quote, sealed himself in secret ceremonies. When his brother begged him to get some divine guidance about plural marriages, Smith claimed another revelation and produced, quote, a new and everlasting covenant in 1843, stating that if any man espouse a virgin and desire to espouse another, and the first give her consent, It is not adultery in God's eyes, even if, quote, he have 10 virgins given unto him by this law. This same revelation allegedly warns Smith's wife, Emma, that if she will not abide this commandment, she shall be destroyed. So Emma kept her peace. But other early Mormon officials were appalled at Smith's behavior. An Illinois Mormon and businessman begged Smith to give up his personal practice of polygamy, upon which Smith promptly excommunicated him. And when that man published a local newspaper exposing the multiple marriages, Smith, who was mayor of this Mormon settlement, called a town meeting at which it was agreed that the paper had to be destroyed. By this time, Smith's new religion had infuriated so many people that the governor of Illinois said Smith should stand trial. When he and his brother Hiram surrendered at a jail in Carthage, Missouri, an angry mob showed up. Jailers apparently did not resist them, and both men were shot to death. Anti-Mormon feelings were so intense that when Smith fell from a window onto the street below, he was propped up against a wall and shot again by a four-man firing squad. But Mormonism, perhaps the most persecuted religion in American history, survived, as did the practice of polygamy. A few years later, in 1866, Brigham Young, Smith's successor, said, "The only men who become gods, even the sons of God, are those who enter into polygamy." He set an example by marrying perhaps 55 women, although this is ignored in an official church biography of his life published about 5 years ago. Some of the women pointed out that they themselves had chosen the arrangement, and it is said that Brigham Young treated those wives well, encouraging them to become lawyers and doctors, and as governor, allowing them to vote long before other women in the United States enjoyed that privilege. After more than 1,000 Mormon men were jailed for polygamy, the U.S. Supreme Court in 1890 okayed the seizing of all Mormon property nationwide, which meant, of course, that the church would be destroyed. For Mormons who believe in continuing revelations, it was fortunate that in that very same year, the church's president got a new revelation declaring polygamy was no longer sanctioned. As the current Mormon president told a journalist the other day, "Polygamy came by revelation and it left by revelation." But while official policy changed, many Mormons who call themselves fundamentalist Mormons quietly ignore it. One of them, who lives near Salt Lake City, responded recently to a journalist's question about his lifestyle by saying, "I proposed to one woman when I was 23, and she's been mine for 65 years. I've never proposed to another, and I've got 8 living wives." "So they proposed to you?" the reporter asked. The old gentleman nodded, "Yes." He said, "See that home over there? That one, this one, and 2 more along the way? Each home belongs to the wife that lives in it. He claims 23 children and 206 grandchildren and says, "I love those kids." A lot of times their mothers will say, "Leave Grandpa alone." And I say, "No, let them come to me." The media, of course, loves to report that kind of violation of official Mormon doctrine, and the church is likely to struggle for a long time yet with the bad publicity those cases cause. This may be a good time to mention that if Mormons relied only upon the Book of Mormon, their differences from other Christians would not be nearly so great. Most of their major doctrines, like baptism for the dead, celestial marriage, God as having been originally a human being, and the possibility of human beings becoming gods, are not even mentioned in the Book of Mormon. But three later revelations profoundly influenced the Mormon creed: the Book of Commandments, the Doctrines and Covenants, and the Pearl of Great Price. And in addition, as already mentioned, the president of the Mormon Church may receive at any time new revelations, and some of these have been extraordinarily timely. The one proclaiming monogamy as the church's policy avoided a potentially disastrous clash with the federal government over polygamy, and after the Civil Rights Act put a spotlight on Mormon discrimination toward blacks, bad publicity and potential lawsuits were avoided 25 years ago when the president of the church received suddenly a new revelation making blacks welcome for the first time ever into full membership. Blacks have since entered the Mormon church in large numbers, especially in Africa. When he was asked about these conveniently timed new directives from God, the current Mormon president told a reporter how natural it seemed to him that God would continue to reveal his will in changing times. And the fact is, of course, that other churches do much the same sort of thing, except that they do it by committees and synods. Many churches, as I speak, are seeking guidance on such matters as women priests and whether gays and lesbians can be ordained to preach. For most outsiders, one of the most esoteric practices of the Mormon Church is what they call baptism for the dead. Despite the fact that the Apostle Paul actually referred to it as a custom in one of his churches. Believing that people who die unbaptized can be saved by proxy baptism, Mormons consider it an act of compassion to line up in the temple and be baptized in behalf of countless people long dead, including, I have read, the Buddha, all the popes, Shakespeare, Einstein, and Elvis Presley, among others. In the early 90s, some Mormons were moved by kindly impulse to be baptized for victims of the Holocaust. But Jews were not delighted and are said now to monitor Mormon baptismal lists to be sure that Jews are not included. What a strange and wondrous thing religion is sometimes, but also often amazingly successful. Mormons, for example, have been phenomenal in raising money and in spending it wisely, once giving the Red Cross its largest single group donation ever at the time, $12 million. Mormons are expected to give one-tenth of their income in order to attend the temple, and are asked in addition to fast one Sunday a month and give the money they would have spent for food to people in need. Their welfare system also has another feature I like very much. They tell recipients, you can receive according to your need, but you are expected to work according to your ability. Less attractive for me was Mormon hostility to the Equal Rights Amendment a few years ago, and their continuing ban against women in either of their two orders of priesthood. But within the limits of their present belief system, they seem to be doing what they can to make women feel important in worship life. And it would not surprise me at all to hear one day of a brand new revelation that would open even more doors. On the plus side, Mormons emphasize a clean and healthy lifestyle with alcohol and tobacco use so low that their lifespans are said to be as much as 11 years longer than the American average. Only the vegetarian Seventh-day Adventists living longer. And I can feel vibrations from the choir that say to me, I told you, that's why we don't eat beef. According to Yale scholar Harold Bloom, they are probably the most work-addicted culture in religious history. This and their deep sense of community are reflected in their use of a beehive as the state symbol. Their success in attracting new members has led to their being ranked fifth just 2 months ago among the 25 largest U.S. churches. They are growing so fast worldwide that the Yale scholar I just mentioned a moment ago thinks they may someday be so many and so wealthy that, his quote, governing our democracy may become impossible without Mormon cooperation. An extraordinary remark from a very bright gentleman. You may have seen Friday's article in the Eagle about the stunning new temple Mormons will dedicate in Nauvoo, Illinois this summer. The article says that 250,000 visitors are expected to attend the open house and the consecration, after which, like all Mormon temples, as opposed to what you would call a local church, it will be closed except to Mormons who are participating in church ceremonies. Sociologists would say that this kind of inner sanctum exclusiveness and mystery can have its own kind of appeal to those who like feeling that they are set apart and that they are among the elect. Steering clear of controversial theology, a Mormon bishop explains their success this way. People are searching for order and organization, and that's what we provide. The young men who spend 2 years of their lives in missionary work are part of that success. 2 years ago, 60,000 of them signed up 274,000 converts. Now, this is an average of fewer than 5 converts per missionary. But their sacrifice, their personal sacrifice, may strengthen the church beyond swelling the rolls. A professor of history at Brigham Young University made this comment. The kids go out and may convert a few here and there, but more importantly, they convert themselves. Mitt Romney, A successful Mormon businessman whom we got to know during the Olympics says that although it can be tough having doors slammed in one's face day after day, the 2 missionary years are extremely valuable. He did his time in France, and he says, it's quite an experience to go to Bordeaux and say, give up your wine, I've got a great religion for you. But since we all get rejected a lot, he says, it's good training for how life works. A university professor and close friend of mine, writing about his visit to a Mormon temple in Dallas, sums up in a single sentence how many other Christians feel when he says that while he's tempted to give Mormons an F in theology, he gladly gives them an A in practical religion. And he admits that he would often have to reverse those grades for his own church. While he prefers to let the Lord issue the final grade reports, he is convinced that Mormons make friendly neighbors, good citizens, and patriotic Americans. A sign on a small Mormon church a few blocks from my home says visitors are welcome, and I have attended a service in accord with my conviction that we better learn the strengths and weaknesses of our own faith if once in a while we step out of our familiar routine and see firsthand how others worship God. I remind you that we do, after all, live in a world where understanding our neighbors may be more important than it has ever been in human history.